Session number 13391, reel number 1.
Mr. Park, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
The actual address was number 2, Fairview, North of Bell Street, Aldous Road, Hull.
Which year was that?
1906.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a deal carrier. At that time, a deal carrier.
On the dock?
On the dock. And at the time, they tell me that there was snow on the ground and no bread in the house, which was something of the conditions that we had to endure in those days.
Did you go to school at North Bell Street?
No, at Courtney Street, which was 2 streets off. So that was a normal elementary school.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
So this was in the Depression?
It's...
No, it was about 1920.
Just before the Depression. I hit the Depression later on. I was also worked for a couple of years or 3 years, I think.
Do you have any First World War memories?
I do. I remember the first when it started on the August day in the street. It was a beautiful day as well. And my father, by that time, had been injured. He fell off a stack of deals, one thing or another. And what really killed him was he couldn't join up. You see, he was in the old militia, and their job in that time was to put a boom across the Humber at Paul, and they used to work from Paul Battery. And it's to my horror that we had a photograph of him in his uniform with a pillbox hat, the red coat. And when mother died, it went to one of the other family and it's got lost. And that I would have loved to have that photograph. But that, you see, when this came, I remember him during an air raid, with air raids, then of course Zepps and the Zeppelins, and we had a little pocket handkerchief of a garden in front of the house. And we were there, and he was pointing out different stars, and I was waiting. Because in those days, when the buzzers went, the main buzzer was on top of Blundell Spence. And we still have it in one of the museums. It's still there. And it isn't very big, steam buzzer, but you could hear that all over Hull. And then the first raid, I fell downstairs asleep, but the second we were out, and the Zeppelin came across very low, and you could see him open the door and chuck the bombs out, because there was the no... In those days, there had no bomb-released equipment, as we had later on. And then, in subsequent raids, they were higher, and they could see the incendiary shot going up. The only gun I think we had it was a wooden one, they tell me, on top of Rose Downs and Thompson's Mill. But we did get some anti-aircraft guns later on with these raids. And they... You could see the Zeppelin, and then the next day they used to publish, or day after, postcards with this little Zeppelin and the searchlights, because you had these searchlights waving about, and so you got the first raids. I think they hit Waller Street, Collier Street, around there. And one raid, the drops, it went over us. We stood on in front of Fairview was a piece of wasteland, which as kids used to play on it, and it was had been a tip for waste, you know, from building materials, and so it was little hills and all sorts of things, and a pond on it. And we stood on that, all the people round about were stood on it, and this noise went across us, and they said that was an aerial torpedo when I was on 11, and I think it dug itself into Sutton Drain Bank, wherever it was. But the main thing is about that war, they got so used to, at the first raids, you got a day off from school because you didn't get any sleep, you see. They cut it down to half a day. Because when it comes so frequent, cut it down to half a day. And things, before rationing came in, they became very chaotic because suddenly everybody was, you went, Maypole Nosey used to make the butter by, pat the butter by hand and everything else.
This is the Maypole Dairy.
Maypole Dairies. And then things got shorter and shorter until they were compelled to, in 1916, to start rationing. And this was a big departure. But for us children, the war, you know, like all the kids were in this war, it was exciting. In other words, as long as you went, particularly, it was exciting, looking for souvenirs. And we used to go looking for German spies. You see, that this was a thing that was absent in the last war. There was a house down our street which was suspected of being German. What was I can't remember what it was, but they threw a piano out the window and smashed the house up. And another thing which happened,
this is a mob that did
the street, in the pit in the street, you know, there was such a hatred of Germans in that century.
Were there Germans in the house?
I don't know what it was. They were supposed to be there, whatever they were. But that was one there. And
whereabouts was this house?
Just down Norneville Street, halfway down. And then my mother, there was a German pork butcher, and his shop, which is still there actually, but it's something else now, was near the old North Bridge. You remember the North Bridge, won't you?
Yes.
And she was in there, and when the war started, he said to her, "They've upset a happy little island, and it'll never be the same again." And it never is.
Who has upset the island?
This German, Porky Bauer. We used to call him Porky Bauer. He was a German. And I'm not sure whether they smashed his windows or what they did, but that's what he said. He said, "They've upset a happy little island, and it'll never be the same again." You see, what the Germans did, and they did in this war, is they sent round these German bands, the two or three instrumentalists, and they're all picking up information. The Graf Zeppelin came round just before the war, and we saw it go. It came the day that our order, when she comes, the day she was born, August the 19th, it came over Hull very, very low. You could read it, the Graf Zeppelin. And then it went right round England, ostensibly, like, sure enough, but it would be taking photographs and ports and installations, everything else. And they're very thorough people, because Hitler was intent on winning world power.
And this I ask you about the rationing. Did you go short of food, personally?
We're always short of food. You see, in those days, my father was when they went on the dock, they used to bring the beer up in buckets. You see, and then everybody had to contribute in a sense, otherwise you didn't get a job. And then they used to, a lot of them used to go in the pub, and then they used to mark it on the slate, and they got paid every night. There wasn't a lot left, and the little shop was open till all hours, little bumper rights, so you had to live from day to day.
But did the rationing make things,
the rationing,
diet worse?
It would make it better. You did at least get something. With I've no recollection of exactly how much we got. You see, when you're a child, you eat what is there. You've no recollection of what it meant to get it. But it was, you got so much butter, so much tea, so much margarine. Meat was a kind of a luxury. Potatoes, yes, that's all right, but meat, and that was a kind of luxury. So you got through as best you could.
But were there things which you craved for which you could not get?
Not to my knowledge. You see, children, their street, it was in that days, their street was their entire surroundings. you see, what's happening there straight? They're like little tribes. We used to go to war with next straight on the kids, and they were different. And so this meant that you'd know a great craving anyway, for maybe for sweets, possibly. Got a few sweets now and again. And you used to look with longing at those fries used to make this thing with a cream filling, fries bar. Because you couldn't get them, like, couldn't afford it. The thing which was cheapest was fish and chips. There was a fish and chip shop top of the street and across there, and you couldn't get a penny of each, which now, I don't know what's a modern penny would buy you fish and chips. The only stipulation was you took your own paper to wrap it up with. And then for many, many years, then we used to go across the field, and we used to take a little basin or a dish and get it in that. Say a penny fish for the chips, and you got a big fish. See, the North Sea was full of fish, and so it was very cheap. You used to get cod as big as that door, you used to hang now and again. But now, of course, they've killed it. And then so that kept us going, like the fish and chips. That's the main recollection. And the other, get rabbit.
You said that your father was so disappointed at not being able to get into the army.
Yeah.
Finally, you suggested that killed him?
It helped so. It helped him. My eldest sister was talking about this. She's dead now. I'm the sole survivor now, out of seven. And that was it. He was probably going anyway. He'd been injured and he got TB in the end. Well, that's what they told me.
Why would they not have him in the army?
He was crippled. He was crippled, you see, falling off this stack of deals.
And yet, he was in the militia.
Oh, before that, as a young man, he was in militia. But then, of course, he wanted to go straight back in the army.
Why was he so keen to fight?
Well, they all were. You see, they all were. And I think in the First World War, my brother went. He was only 17. And they give a false age to get in. And we lost him when we lost a lot of Hull lads. He was in Colonel Shaw's mob. And May the 3rd, 1917, that's when they lost most of the Hull men. And they had used to have a memorial service in Holy Trinity every May the 3rd. And Mother took me to the last one, you know, the slowly got worse and worse. And we went to the last one, held in a little chapel at Holy Trinity Church.
Why did the Hull men die on the 3rd of May 1917?
It was an attack on the Somme. You see, in those days, well, in the army, as against the Air Force or the Navy, you've got local battalions. They're always in PALS brigades and all like that, you see. And this went right through the country. The Lancashire lads and the other. They were all together. And they were in this action, Colonel Shaw's lot. And apparently they were more or less wiped out, just about.
See, were they called the Hull PALS?
I don't know. They'd probably be the 4th East Yorks, I think. 4th Regiment with East Yorks. I think there was a Hull PALS battalion. You can get those records from that. Well, that's when they went. And we never knew he was posted missing, then wounded and missing. And we never found out exactly how he did die, or where he died, and what happened to him, like lots of others. And now, I was in a church last weekend in near Sowerby, near Thirsk, the church that goes back to the 11th century. And on the wall is two memorials, one to the last World War and one to the First World War. Now, the one to the First World War is the size of that curtain, with three columns of the dead and wounded. The one to this war is about as big as that mirror. And in this last war, the only man we lost in the city engineers, right in the city engineers, in our office, was one who was killed. He joined the Long Range Desert Group. He was and he got killed raiding Rommel's headquarters. He was the only one that we lost.
Have you any more specific memories about the air raids on Hull in the First World War?
That was the main memory, is seeing the Zeps and there's never any fear. Never any fear. Just noise, and because we often had the buzzers when nothing turned up. Then in the summer, lots of people used to sleep in the fields if it was warm enough and go out in the fields.
In the First World War?
Aye. They used to drift away into the fields. And I think a lot of them did in the Second World War as well. But the see, if we didn't come near you, a Zeppelin raid was not like these modern air raids. It was very, very localised. And very often they never got to you. The buzzers would go at 8 or 10, whatever it was, and there'd be hours and hours and before they ever arrived. And of course they didn't arrive, then the all clear went and life went back. So he eventually he stayed in bed.
What do you remember of the day on which the armistice occurred, the 11th of November 1918?
Well, the main memory of that is in jubilation we all had street parties. And the one thing we did, we, because again, as children of no recollection, we made a stretcher out of the beds in those days were either straw mattresses or flop beds. And these flop beds were in these, granite, I suppose it was kind of twill cases, you see. And Mother had one of these. So we slotted two scantlings through two pieces of wood. And that made a stretcher. And then we made an effigy of Kaiser Bill. And we took him round, you see. And then we had a bonfire and we threw it on the bonfire. But unfortunately, that... that didn't please Mother because that was a blooming Bentinck gun for a burn. But children, you see, children don't, you have no sense of value in that sense. You just do it. And so we had every street, every terrace had a party. But
was there any disorder on that?
No, there was never any disorder. One of the things which finished in 15 was my father, when he couldn't work, and August Bank Holiday, he started the kids in the street. He started them racing, little races, and he bought some sweets, and this thing developed. I don't know how many years it went on, but it developed. So they call it Parksy Sports, and he used to collect from the local people, and I always remember there was a model of a ship which I envied very much, but I couldn't win it. I couldn't race and win it. And there was this field, as I say, in front of us, and you used to get up. It was a fine day. They all seemed to be a fine day on August Monday. You used to sweep the field, sweep the track. It was only like clay track. Sweep that, keep it clean. And then they organised these races, three leg races. And then the women used to have races. It's great hilarity. And then they had the gazunders, the jerrys. Well, they had one or two of them full of beer with sausages floating on the top. It was very broad humour, but it was great.
Was this in the First World War?
This was just as it came. And then, of course, about 15, he died, and that finished it. My eldest brother came home once, our Ted. Have his photo there. And the memory of that is seeing his rifle stood in the corner of the room. And the father was then on his last, and he was allowed home just that visit, and that was it.
Do you think people were more patriotic in the First World War?
Well, it was a different kind of patriotism. You've got to remember that throughout the Victorian era, when the spread of the British Empire, and these people, and I've worked with men on the streets and that, and they'd fought all over the world. Say Northwest India, you name it, that we'd fought everybody, haven't we? We'd fought all over the world. And so, as one chap said to me once during this war, a naval officer, I was in one of the last raids of the war, I was going back to camp, and he was in this train, and I often wish I'd have known who he was, because it was somebody very important. We was waiting while the raid was over, and he'd been at Stalingrad, so you know he was something very high up. And we got talking, and he said, you know, when this war is over, then Jerry will rather Russia, Joe, we used to call him Joe, Uncle Joe Stalin, he'll want the whole of Germany and Austria and there and all these places as a buffer against the West, because he does not trust the West, and he'll want 5 million slaves. He got them to and he got this, just about got that in the, you know. And he said another thing, he said, you'll find a whole man, at least one old man, on every ship in the Navy. And he said another thing is that because of the water, then it comes through the choke, so it's rich in calcium, so the people around East Riding have very strong bones, he said, and this resulted, he said, the very good marches. And it was the 15th foot, which was locally raised, that took Quebec.
East Yorkshire.
Yes, the kind of 15 foot it was in those days. And he said, this is one of the things that's differentiating people, that they're very strong, so they can do the route marches and everything else. Today we get water from the river, which isn't quite the same thing. It's a softer water. But then it was a very hard, calcium laden water. But I often wondered who he was. I'd like to know who he was. But come back to my father died, this you might find this surprising, which I didn't know at the time, but this sister was talking one day, she said to mother, now we only had like this is a working type house, isn't it, so we have this room and we have that kitchen, then I've added that toilet because we bought this house, you see. But in Ornabell Street, and there's some of these streets, I was like that. He just got the one room and the door opened straight into the street, whatever, one room, and then a kind of a scullery, and then a backyard and a cold water tap, and that was it. And two bedrooms, and we had seven of us, so there's nine people in that house, and never a great bother to I know. And then so you see, she said to when her father died, there was no chapels of repose then, you know, and so the body was kept at home till the funeral. And she said, well, what did you do? So she said, well, I had to sleep with him all night, see, in the room. And she said, he never harmed me in life, why should he harm me in death? It's astonishing, isn't it? And this didn't occur again, he said, but it's something which is changing the way. But my brother, because the next eldest brother, he served in the Guards for 3 years, then he served in the fire service during the war. And his wife, when she died, he sat with her the whole night. She was in a coffin. And he held her hand, and her hand was as warm next day and pliable. And he sat with her. He was a very undemonstrative, but that was it. It's astonishing what people get, you see. But that was a remarkable thing when you got to think of these small houses that ought now been overcrowded when they're about five.
Now, can we come on to the Second World War?
Yes.
And can you tell me what you were doing when Chamberlain declared war on Germany in September 1939?
Yes, I can tell you. I was working then with I was a chain man with a city engineer, which was a kind of a surveyor's assistant. And we had a little crowd of us just at the back of the Guildhall. They were now changed it all up. And I started to dig an air raid shelter at the back of the house. Unfortunately, you cannot build underground shelters in Hull. The corporation started it. They started immediately building Erith shelters, and they built one in what's then Bilton Grange, and they rapidly filled with water. You see, the average height of all these streets in Hull is 6.5 feet above sea level, and so it's even lower at one just out of Sutton. And so, apart from a very, very hot weather, you can't dig more than 2 or 3 feet down before you're flooded. And unfortunately, one poor little bairn fell in this trench, and built this trench and shored them up, and she was drowned, poor little lass. And so I'd dug about 3 or 4 feet and then went to give it up. Eventually, of course, we got Anderson shelters, and then we got a brick shelter.
Where did you live in those?
I lived in Cranswick Grove, which isn't far from here. It's been pulled down since.
Right near Preston Road?
Yes, just to go to Preston Road. It was built under the Boot system, Sir Henry Boot, which is, I think, that firm's still going. And all these houses, as you go around Preston Road and round it, you notice they're all mostly concrete. If you look, they're mostly concrete. And so what they discovered was they have beams to support them, and they had wire reinforcing, you see. The breeze blocks were made on site, these houses, and then they suddenly started to rust, the steel started to rust. Now, I didn't know this, you may, I don't know, but my son, as I say, is with the atomic energy people, and he's telling me that, you know, that water is incompressible. You can't compress water. So is rust. You don't believe that, would you? Rust is incompressible. And so when it rusts, it blows the concrete. And I've often wondered, you see these concrete posts and you see that lots missing and just seeing a wire. And that's the reason. And so the government, we just bought the house, and it was the day my brother had just died, second brother, and I came home with a letter on the mat that your house is going to be pulled down. And we just bought it, painted it and everything else. And so I went and got the minutes of the committee and discovered this, and discovered that there was a rolling programme. And I got the local paper interested. I got an article in the local paper about this. Because one chap, he lives across there now, he made a beautiful garden and everything. But the houses had to come down. Now the government's...
When was that?
This was 5 years ago.
Oh, but can we go back to the beginning of the Second World War? Because you were telling me what happened to you when Chamberlain declared war.
That was it, see. Was everybody knew that it was false. When he come back waving that piece of paper, said, "Get ready, lads, you have a year." And that's it. We all knew that, not automatically. And I had an allotment then, and one with a little dustman, he wouldn't leave me. And there was a German ship in the dock. And on these German ships, there were commissars, like the Russians. And because the chap was telling me, he happened to speak to one of the crew. And next day when he went on the docker, he said, "Where is he?" He said, "He's in the Uskow, in the cells for speaking to you, see." There was that control over them. And so this little dustman said to me, he said, "You know, it could be that as working men, we wouldn't be anywhere so far with the Germans than our own people, because there's no good bosses, really." He said, "But we can't see ourselves beaten." And this was the main thing, we can't see ourselves beaten. And so everybody then started to get ready. Immediately, I was working with an architect then, helping to survey and set out housing things for the city architect. Immediately, all copper piping